They called them accidents, suicides, breakdowns, but I know the truth, because I was there when Clara's blood was wiped from the piano keys. I heard the tape Ginny left before they buried her story in red tape. I saw the names carved into the attic walls of Ashgrove Sanitarium. And when I met Naomi, the girl they never wanted found, I realized this isn't just one family's darkness. It's a system built on silence, money, and manipulation. These are the true crime stories they paid to erase. The shadows of justice where daughters disappear. But their secrets couldn't stay buried forever. Not while I'm still breathing. Behind Closed Doors isn't just another crime podcast. It's what happens when the girls they silenced finally speak back. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The Blood on the Keys. The piano was older than I was, an upright antique with ivory keys yellowed by time and secrets. It sat at the far end of the studio, just beneath the tall stained glass window where the morning sun always felt too sharp. I remember the exact morning I walked into that room and saw it. The blood. It wasn't splattered wildly. It was quiet, controlled. A smear on the middle C, a fingerprint trailing down the lower octave, like someone had tried to play a final note in the middle of dying. That was the last day Clara was seen alive. They called it a tragic accident. Said she slipped on a rug and hit her head against the piano's side. But Clara didn't play piano that well. She would never have come to that studio alone. And the blood patterns? They didn't align with any kind of slip and fall. I knew something darker lived in that room. Something layered beneath the surface of our perfect family image. My aunt, her mother, wore black that week, but her eyes were dry. When the detectives came, she offered them tea and smiled as if this was just another cocktail party. I remember the unease that settled in my chest when she closed the door behind them and whispered, "Let's not overdramatize things. It's better for the estate if this fades quickly." The Carver's estate was a fortress of influence. Marble halls, vintage paintings, a private vineyard, and a study lined with mahogany shelves holding secrets instead of books. One of those secrets, I would soon learn, was a drawer filled with offshore accounts, fake charities, and rerouted donation checks. No one wanted to talk about Clara. Not at the wake. Not at the family board meeting, where her trust was quietly absorbed back into the estate. Not even my cousin Elijah, who was closest to her. But I could see it eating him alive. Every night he sat on the back porch, drinking too much and whispering fragments of sentences into the wind. "It wasn't supposed to go like that," he'd mumble. Or, "They said the studio would be empty." Then one night Elijah was gone. Another accident. This time a hunting mishap. I didn't believe it for a second. Elijah hated hunting. Couldn't even hold a rifle properly. But the sheriff signed off on the report without question. Said it was unfortunate, but boys will be boys. No forensic sweep. No autopsy. Just another chapter sealed by red tape, bureaucracy, and the sickening weight of financial corruption. That's when I started my own investigation. I began digging through old estate records, tracing financial transactions, hunting for anything that didn't fit. And that's when I found the ribbon, Clara's ribbon, stuffed in the piano's soundboard. Bloodstained. Hidden. I took it straight to the police. A young detective tried to help, but within a week, he was reassigned. The case was marked inactive. And me? I received an anonymous warning note that read, "Stop playing detective. This family buries more than secrets." It chilled me, but it didn't stop me. I turned to storytelling secrets, recording everything I found, dates, interviews, photographs. I began documenting what I now call my nightly reflections. Whispered truths about hidden killers, wealth shielding, and the lies carved into the DNA of family names. That's how I uncovered the trail to Savannah, to the second victim, to another story buried under Southern charm and lies. But before we go there, you need to understand something. This piano, it didn't just hold music. It held murder. And Clara? She was the first, but not the last. The Southern girl who knew too much. Savannah is the kind of place that wears beauty like a mask. Spanish moss drapes from the trees like silk scarves hiding bruises. White columns, manicured lawns, pastel-painted porches. All of it a performance. But underneath, there's rot. Not just in the woodwork. In the families. In the stories no one's allowed to tell. Her name was Virginia May Dupree, but everyone called her Ginny. Blonde, blue-eyed, raised with perfect posture and a debutante smile. She was 18 when she vanished. They found her body 2 days later in the family garden, tucked behind the rose trellis like a forgotten statue. It was July, the air thick with heat, magnolias, and lies. The obituary said she died of natural causes. But the bruises on her neck? They told another story. I was connected to Ginny through her cousin, Lillian, who reached out after hearing whispers about Clara's case. They did the same to Ginny, she said over the phone, voice trembling. They erased her. That one sentence sent me spiraling into the darkest corners of Southern aristocracy, where old money meant control and bloodlines meant silence. The Dupree estate was generations old, steeped in legacy and stained history. Behind every family photo was a skeleton. I arrived posing as a freelance journalist writing about Southern architecture. What I was really after was the piano studio. Yes, another one, built into the East Wing. It was where Ginny practiced almost daily. But this piano had a broken pedal and a cracked lid, damage that had never been explained. Until I opened the bench and found it. A torn letter written in Ginny's hand, the ink smudged with what looked like dried tears. If you find this, I was right. I think Daddy's hiding something in the cellar. I heard them arguing again. I'm scared. I don't think I'll make it to my debut. The handwriting was frantic, rushed, fearful. I followed her clue straight to the basement, a heavy iron door beneath the grand staircase, sealed with a padlock older than I was. I picked it open and stepped into darkness that swallowed the flashlight beam like smoke. The air was damp, sour, and the stairs creaked like bones. At the bottom was a row of rusted filing cabinets, and a large mirror with blood spatter along the bottom right corner. The files, they were coded, labeled under charities I later traced to offshore accounts and shell organizations. But even more disturbing was the reel of cassette tapes in the corner, each marked with dates and initials. One was labeled VMD, Final Lesson. I listened. It started with a piano scale, then a male voice. You will not speak of this again, Virginia. I won't have this family fall into scandal because of your imagination. Then a smack. Then a gasp. Then silence. Then the piano again. I left that basement shaking. I didn't sleep for 3 nights. That was my introduction to the depths of crime. Not crimes of passion, but carefully curated, financially shielded, legacy-driven murder tales where the only justice came from uncovering their patterns. I tried to go to the local sheriff. I should have known better. He was at Ginny's funeral. A family friend, they said. He waved off my evidence as inconclusive. Sound familiar? The same red tape, the same shadows of justice. But I couldn't let it go. I began putting the pieces together. The Southern secrets, the unsettling narratives, the whispers passed down by maids and gardeners and cousins who'd moved far enough away to speak. What emerged was a chilling map of stories just like Clara's. Just like Ginny's. Daughters silenced. Sons disposed of. Secrets wrapped in polite hospitality and enforced with financial scams and cover-ups. I followed Ginny's trail right to the edge of something bigger. The tapes hinted at another girl, one who had escaped before she could be silenced. Someone who might still be alive. Her name was Samira, and the last known address I had for her? A children's music conservatory, privately funded. Quiet, remote, and very, very off the grid. She's the next chapter. But even I wasn't ready for what she'd survived. The conservatory's forgotten girl. The conservatory sat just outside New Orleans, tucked behind iron gates and flanked by oak trees that reached so high they strangled the sunlight. From the outside, it looked serene, like a private sanctuary for gifted youth. But as I stood at the edge of its property, listening to the faint echo of music drifting from the open windows, I felt it in my bones. Something terrible happened here. I didn't come unannounced. I'd spent weeks tracing financial corruption through a web of offshore accounts that all pointed back to a music scholarship fund supporting this place. On paper, it was an elite arts institution. But buried in the legal filings were payments to non-existent students and, more disturbingly, massive transfers to shell organizations registered in Cyprus. Wealth shielding at its most precise. I was posing as a documentary filmmaker this time. The headmistress, a skeletal woman named Madame Eloise, greeted me with a warm but stiff smile and a grip that lasted a second too long. Her eyes scanned me the way predators do when assessing whether a thing is prey or threat. She gave me a tour. Practice rooms, dance halls, soundproof booths. Everything too quiet. Too perfect. I asked about alumni. She rattled off names like a script, but never mentioned Samira. Not once. Even when I held up a photo. Just a polite. I'm afraid I don't know that student. But later that evening, one of the janitors slipped me a folded note. Just one line. Room 3B. basement, midnight, come alone. So I did. That basement was colder than death. Old brick walls, flickering lights, echoes I couldn't place. And there she was, Samira, not a ghost, not a myth. A girl grown into a woman with scars you couldn't see until she started talking. She wore a hoodie two sizes too big, hands trembling as she lit a cigarette with shaking fingers. "You shouldn't have come here," she said. "They watch everything." I told her about Clara, about Ginny, about the chilling details that connected all their stories like threads in a web. She didn't blink, just exhaled smoke and whispered. They trained us not to talk. Music and silence were the only things allowed. Samira had been 12 when she was brought here. A scholarship from a family foundation. In reality, a trade. She was the daughter of a whistleblower accountant who disappeared in 2009 after investigating financial scams tied to federal contracts. After he vanished, Samira was placed in Madame Eloise's care. She endured 6 years of psychological manipulation masked as discipline. No mirrors, no clocks, no voices louder than mezzo piano. She was punished for crying. Punished harder for asking questions. In her words, "They tried to compose us into something forgettable." Then she showed me her notebook. It was water-damaged, frayed at the edges, but filled with handwritten timelines, family names, symbols, everything. At the center, a diagram connecting Carver's estate, the Dupree Foundation, and a fake nonprofit called Hearts for Harmony, which was laundering money through the conservatory. She circled one name in red ink: Daniel Carver, Clara's uncle. The same man who allegedly took Elijah on that fatal hunting trip. It was all connected. She leaned in, eyes glassy but burning with clarity. "They're not families. They're syndicates. Bloodlines built on silence. The kind that turn truth into suicide notes and justice into rumors. I wanted to bring her with me. To protect her. But she refused. Said she had one more piece of evidence buried behind the old recital hall. A box hidden beneath the floorboards. She agreed to dig it up and contact me the next night. That call never came. Instead, I received a manila envelope delivered to my motel. No name, no return address. Inside, one torn notebook page scorched at the edges. Samira's handwriting. If you're reading this, they found me first. Don't stop. And taped to the corner, a photo. A grainy still from a surveillance monitor, showing a man walking into the conservatory's west wing. Daniel Carver. That night, I didn't sleep. I sat on the floor, surrounded by Samira's notes, Ginny's tapes, Clara's bloodstained ribbon, and a mounting terror that the closer I got to the truth, the more dangerous this story became. But I was in too deep to turn back. And I'd just found the next breadcrumb. A clue scrawled in the corner of Samira's map. One word. Ashgrove. An address in Alabama. A mansion with no online presence. But locals whispered it used to be a sanitarium. And I had a strong feeling the next family secret? It was buried in Ashgrove's locked attic. Ashgrove's attic doesn't forget. Ashgrove looked abandoned from the road. A crooked gate, chipped paint, ivy that swallowed everything in its path. But the moment I stepped through the rusted entrance, I knew I wasn't alone. There was an energy in the air, thick and charged, like the house was holding its breath. Waiting. The estate was older than most of the crime scenes I'd visited. Built in the 1880s, later used as a private sanitarium for disturbed women of wealthy families. The records were shredded years ago under the guise of privacy. But I'd found a reference to it in one of Samira's files. One line. Ashgrove holds the ledger. Carver's oldest sin. Inside, the floors groaned beneath my feet. Dust coated everything. Family portraits stared down like judges from the afterlife. I climbed the grand staircase, heart thudding. Every door I passed was warped, water-stained, or chained shut. But at the very top of the east wing was the attic door, painted over, but not locked. I pried it open and stepped into a room frozen in time. Children's toys. A cracked mirror. Sheet music pinned to the wall with thumbtacks. And at the center, a rocking chair facing the window, still swaying. I shouldn't have felt terror. But I did. And then I saw it. Carved into the baseboard beneath the window. Dozens of tally marks. And one name scratched in over and over like a prayer or a curse. Lenora. 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 I didn't know who Lenora was yet. But I would soon. There was a cedar chest near the rocking chair. Inside, a handbound ledger, a rosary, and a stack of yellowed photographs. Dozens of young girls all wearing the same white gown. Some smiling. Some not. One photograph was labeled, Lenora Carver, admission date, July 14, 1927. She was 12. As I turned the pages of the ledger, my stomach dropped. It wasn't a patient file. It was a payment log. Names of wealthy families. Dates. Notes. Some as cold as disposition handled. Others red, transferred, uncooperative. And several were marked with symbols I'd seen in the conservatory's files. These weren't records of healing. These were sales, reassignments, disappearances. Ashgrove wasn't just a place of confinement. It was a holding cell for inconvenient daughters. A place where money erased lineage and trauma was rewritten as illness. The Carvers were everywhere in that ledger. Payments, referrals, even signed documents from a D. Carver trustee. Could it have been Daniel's grandfather? Or Daniel himself, using an alias? Either way, the paper trail was unmistakable. Then I found her. Lenora Carver's file, the only one with personal notes. Subject displays emotional instability. Refuses to accept arranged marriage. Accuses father of violence. Recommends long-term sedation and isolation. Final note, dated 1931. Subject no longer verbal. Disposition to be finalized. No date of death. No grave. Just finalized. I began documenting everything. Took photos. Recorded voice memos. My pulse was racing, my hands shaking. But I knew I had something. This was the origin. The root of the Carver legacy of silence and erasure. A bloodline that had been sanitizing its own daughters for generations. That's when I heard it. A low creak behind me. I turned. Nothing. But when I looked back at the mirror, there was a handprint in the dust. Not mine. Not fresh. But deliberate. I grabbed the ledger, locked it in my bag, and rushed out. I didn't look back. That night, I slept in my car on the side of the highway. Too afraid to be in a motel. Too shaken to trust locked doors. I kept replaying that attic in my mind, the photographs, the tallies, the carved name. Lenora. I searched the next day for a death certificate. Found nothing. No records. No mentions. Until I reached out to a local historian, an older black woman named Miss Geraldine, who ran a genealogy archive out of her own living room. She invited me in, offered sweet tea, and sat me down like I was family. I told her what I'd found. She nodded slowly. My grandmother worked in Ashgrove, she said. The girls used to call it the house where names go missing. She remembered a child named Lenora. Said she used to hum while drawing on the attic floor. Then one day, she was just gone. I asked her if there were any descendants, any trail to follow. She hesitated, then slid a small card across the table. A church, outside Birmingham, built on land once owned by the Carvers. Still operating, with a private burial ground in the back. Geraldine leaned in. If you want Lenora's truth, that's where you'll find it. But be careful. That land, it still belongs to them. They don't like visitors. Another thread. Another shadow of justice dangling, just out of reach. And yet, I knew I had to go. Because if there's one thing I've learned, addicts don't forget. They just wait for someone to finally open the box. The churchyard beneath the Carvers. I arrived just before dusk. The church was small, wooden, and leaned slightly to the right like time had bent it. Set deep in the Alabama backwoods, it sat on land so quiet it rang in my ears. Behind the church was what I had come for. A burial ground with no names on the stones, just numbers. Rows and rows of anonymous markers. Weathered. Forgotten. Swallowed by weeds. There were 37 of them. But I was looking for one. Lenora. Miss Geraldine had been right. The church was still active, barely. And when I slipped in through the side door, an old man was tuning a piano beneath a crucifix cracked down the center. He looked up slowly. Said nothing. Just stared. Until I whispered, I'm looking for someone who was never supposed to be found. He stared for another moment, then nodded once. You're here for the girl who sang to the trees. He led me to the back office, no bigger than a closet, and pulled out a rusted tin box from under the floorboard. Inside were ledgers. Notes. A funeral registry without causes of death. One entry made my blood go cold. Number 19, Lenora C. No family claimed. Interned quietly. No ceremony. There was a hand-drawn map next to it. A layout of the graveyard. Plot 19. Unmarked. Near the far tree line. My hands were shaking as I took a picture. As if documenting her finally gave her a name again. I asked the old man if anyone ever came to visit the graves. He gave me a bitter smile. Only two types of people come here. The ones who forgot. And the ones trying not to be forgotten. That night, I waited until the sky turned black. I crept through the graves with a flashlight and a shovel. Yes, I know how that sounds. But this was about more than discovery. This was about truth. about dragging it into the light, clawed and dirt-covered if need be. I didn't dig far, just enough to reach the wooden crossbeam beneath the surface. And there, tucked in a slot beneath the grave marker, was a rusted locket and a folded piece of linen. On it, stitched in fading thread, were the initials LC and a stitched message. He said I was broken. I said I was awake. Tell them I lived. Lenora had left her truth right beneath their feet. She may have died, but she hadn't disappeared. The next morning, I filed for a formal exhumation request. It was denied within 6 hours. Buried beneath improper filing, more red tape, and Carver-connected legal interference. But that didn't matter. I had photos, physical proof. And soon after, a forensic contact of mine confirmed something chilling. The stitching on the linen matched embroidery work from a sewing circle once held at Ashgrove Sanitarium, and the metallic compounds in the locket, only used in a specific jewelry line distributed through a Carver-funded charity in 1926. Another thread connected. That night, I recorded my nightly reflections with a different tone in my voice. One not just of grief, but defiance. I knew the Carver family was listening, watching, and now they were nervous. I could feel it. My phone began glitching. My emails went missing. A black SUV idled outside my apartment for 3 nights straight. Still, I kept going. Then 2 days later, a package arrived at my door. No return address. Inside, a cassette tape, labeled only, The Final Confession. I found a recorder, slid the tape in, and pressed play. It was an old man's voice, worn, shaking. My name is Franklin Carver. I'm dying now, and I don't want to take the weight with me. He began listing names, daughters, nieces, students, how they were institutionalized, silenced, eliminated under the guise of family protection. Then came the bombshell. We made a mistake with Lenora. She knew too much. Daniel tried to continue the work. The conservatory was just the new model. But it's all the same. Control through fear. Silence through wealth. I know what we are. I know what I am. I killed my brother to keep this legacy safe. Now I die with it. I dropped the recorder. Because at that moment, I realized, this wasn't just a family tree. It was a root system of rot. A generational machine of abuse wrapped in money and sealed with piano wire and trust funds. And it was still operating. But now I had something no one could deny, a confession. I just needed to get it out. To true crime fans, to journalists, to those who'd buried their own secret stories hoping someone might care enough to dig. That's when I got the message. Typed, no name, sent to my burner phone. You're about to uncover the one we never wanted found. Stop now or she dies too. She, was it Samira? No, it was someone else. Another girl, alive, hidden in a safe house funded by a Carver-controlled nonprofit. They were still keeping them. And this time, I wouldn't just uncover the story. I'd go in and get her out. The last daughter. They didn't give her a name. Not in the records, not in the files, not even in the financial logs I uncovered. Just a number. Subject 7A. As if stripping her name could erase her existence. But they were wrong. She had a name. Her name was Naomi. And she was very much alive. Finding the safe house was like peeling back the last layer of a wound. Hidden beneath a religious charity called Hope's Door. It operated out of an old farmhouse on the outskirts of Charleston, fenced off and gated, with no signage, no public records, no visitors allowed. Everything about it screamed wealth shielding, a place funded through carefully curated financial scams under the guise of healing and rehabilitation. But this wasn't a clinic. It was a prison. I went in with a fake identity, posing as a wellness therapist offering private consultations. It was a risk. But I couldn't leave Naomi buried in silence like all the girls before her. The first thing I noticed inside was the quiet. Too quiet. No music. No laughter. Just the ticking of a grandfather clock and the occasional murmur behind thick walls. Then I saw her. She couldn't have been more than 17, with long black hair and eyes that scanned the room like she was always calculating an escape route. She didn't speak right away. But when I handed her a photo of Lenora, she froze. Then whispered, she told me someone would come. Naomi had been there for 4 years. No visitors. No education. No real therapy. Just daily prayers, pills, and what they called reflection hours, silent confinement in a soundproof room. She wasn't even allowed to speak her birth name until 2 years in. I asked her why they brought her here. She swallowed hard. I knew about the tapes. My mother hid one. When I found it, they said I was sick. That I was possessed by lies. Then she leaned in and added, they weren't trying to heal me. They were trying to make sure I forgot. What Naomi remembered, what she survived, was the final piece. She had overheard a meeting between two men discussing the last case that needs silencing. One of the names they mentioned? Mine. That meant they were coming. For me. For her. But for the first time in this entire journey, I didn't feel fear. I felt resolve. I recorded Naomi's story that same night. In her voice. In her words. I hid copies in multiple cloud backups, sent a burner copy to a journalist friend in DC, and one to a podcaster who had begged for my story months ago. I knew time was running out, because at 3:12 a.m. they came. Black SUV. No lights. Just like before. But this time I was ready. Naomi and I escaped through the backwoods, using a route I'd planned 2 days earlier. We ran until our legs failed, until dawn cracked through the pines like a lifeline. We didn't stop until we reached a safe zone 3 counties away. She's with people now, real people, outside the Carver influence. And her story? It's already live. The audio was released to every major outlet. True crime fans, whistleblower groups, and investigative storytelling podcasts picked it up within hours. The hashtag #TheLastDaughter started trending before noon. And the Carver name? It's burning. The tapes are out. The ledger is public. The offshore accounts are being investigated. And finally, there's nowhere left for them to hide. The shadows of justice have cracked. I still don't sleep much. Sometimes I sit in the dark, listening to the recordings. Not to terrify myself, but to remember. Clara's ribbon. Ginny's tape. Samira's notebook. Lenora's linen. Naomi's voice. Each one was a stone. And together, they became a weapon. They tried to erase these girls. Tried to rewrite their lives as murder tales swept beneath red tape. Stitched into investigation narratives no one would dare reopen. But this is the true crime story they never wanted told. This is the thrilling narrative of daughters who refused to disappear. And I'm still here. Still telling their stories. Still diving into crime that bleeds past the headlines. Because as long as one girl is silenced, as long as one chilling narrative hides behind a family name, the story isn't over.